When calling down beings of ancient starlight, tune in, Mosh to the Apocalypse on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come to our forum at MavisIncarnate.com.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to A Global Focus with guest Chris Hawley, writer and researcher on paranormal and contemporary topics, and creator of Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website. Welcome, everyone. Therese Sheridan speaking, host of A Global Focus. Tonight's guest is Chris Hawley. The program, A Global Focus, airs live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with its anchor station, UPRN 105.7 FM, New Orleans. Other venues for listening include Live 365, U.S. Stream TV, Shoutcast and Awcast, and by mobile phone through dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. Also, thank you to Joe Montaldo, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. Tonight's program features Chris Hawley, writer and researcher on paranormal and contemporary topics, and creator of Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website and sister site. Chris reports her research findings and experiences through true accounts, memorable for their interesting format and insightful content. Chris not only details her own experiences, but also those of her readers from the United States and across the globe. These individuals can relate their experiences to Chris without fear of revealing their identity. Chris takes pride in maintaining the privacy of her sources. Chris frequently appears as guest on radio, internet programs to discuss the latest developments in her fields. At this time, Chris is writing two books projected to be published in late 2011 and early 2012. Now, for your review during the discussion here, the webpage for Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website can be found at endlessjrny.blogspot.com, and the sister site can be found at chrishawley2.blogspot.com. Valuable websites, valuable book spots. Chris, welcome to the show. Your paranormal research has covered a wide field spectrum, and your accounts of experiences span the globe. We're looking forward to your updates. Also, thank you for creating those blogs and your articles and permitting people from across the globe to relate their experiences and access important information.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Chris, going over your blog sites, there's so much information. You cover all the paranormal fields. Wherever you want to start, current articles, UFOs, ghosts, paranormal, insights on the upcoming year, this year of 2012, where would you like to start?
Oh, gee, that's quite a spectrum there. I think I'm going to start by telling you something very interesting that happened to my family personally just the other night. I started writing about the paranormal because years and years and years ago, I had an incident, an encounter with a red orb that was very, very strange and changed my entire life because it introduced the problems of the paranormal that were being, encountered by so many people to the fore. But it also cemented in my own mind that these problems, for me personally, were going to be lifelong. So one of my problems was one night in a tree outside of my house, I had an encounter with a red orb. And it was not pleasant because, I say, it knocked me out. I felt extremely dizzy, and I was with my first husband at the time, and we both passed out and woke up the next day, and it was a long story from there. that was years and years ago, and I've written about orbs since. Many people report seeing them to me, and I always tell them, if you see one, try to stay away from it. Leave it. Don't stand there and look at it. You know, lock yourself away and be careful. It was two nights ago now. My husband was outside walking one of our dogs with another family member, and they came running back in to tell me, come look down the hill. I live on Long Island on the North Shore. It's very much like New England where I live. It's very hilly and cliffs down to the water, which is Sandy Beach and Rock Beach, very much like Connecticut or New England. And I came outside, went up on the hill, very annoyed at them for making me climb up there to look down. And down into the valley of my neighborhood was one of our houses. The houses are very spread apart. Was one of my neighbor's houses. And outside, maybe 100 feet over the house, was a red orb. Well, I immediately panicked because I was seeing another one, and I didn't fare too well the first time around. So I immediately retreated to call the police, and my husband, and it was my brother, were there, watched it hover slowly down at the side of the house and just stay there. Knowing my past and what had happened to me, they also came back to the house, and we just called for help and called the neighbor, told them to stay in the house. They didn't know what we were talking about, and I don't know what happened from there, because we called the authorities, and I hid from this thing. The next day, we did go back and look down the hill, because I thought to myself, oh, they must have a window where there's some kind of light there. And we went and looked. There's no windows on the side of the house. There's nothing but trees, and they definitely had a red orb in their yard going up and down slowly along the side of their house. So that was interesting for me, to have another incident in my life with these mysterious balls of whatever they are.
Well, you know, Chris, I can't give specifics here because it was a confidence, but I remember encountering one of the really bright people in ICAR, and one of the members there, well, perhaps a non-member now, had also told me of something that was a red orb throughout her life, and that it was an important aspect of her ET contact. But now, when you reference orbs, Chris, one of your many very interesting articles is one entitled When Level-Headed People Encounter the Unknown, UFOs, and Lost Time, end quote.
Yes.
And you recount the experience of a very pragmatic Canadian UFO investigator who had an encounter with friends on the shores of Lake Ontario in the Toronto area, and he and friends had seen a large orange crescent-shaped object with two orbs in the vicinity, all three over the lake. Here's another orb aspect.
Interesting, yes, and he is not a UFO investigator. He has little interest in UFOs, which makes this experience much more interesting to me. He does other aspects of the paranormal and really did not have interest at all. Because he's friends with me, and we do talk about all these things, but he is more interested in what he looks at, and I'm biggest interest is UFO and aliens and abduction and lost time. However, anything interesting I want to know about. But he was one of the last people I ever thought would tell me about the encounter that he had. And he also got very ill after that encounter, if you remember from the article. He was perfectly fine. And after the experiences of seeing that over the lake, he then had an experience on his street where there was some type of oval dark circle hovering over the, or about the same height as the telephone wires, and going slowly down the road where he could first saw the big shadow on the street and immediately filled with fear and knew to run back to his house and get away from it. After that experience, he had a lost time event that he still was not sure what was going on, because it was only like, I think, like 25 or 30 minutes. But he did, during the night, consciously lose that. He was awake during it, could not explain what happened to him in like a half hour time. After that, this gentleman started to get terrible, terrible, severe back pain and had no reason for it, and went through the whole thing of, you know, CAT scans and x-rays and doctor visits to be told, well, you seriously injured your vertebrae and you're all have bulging discs, and the specific of his injury could have only come from some type of injury or accident, and absolutely nothing had happened to him. It started to get a little nasty between him and the doctors, because nothing did happen to him, but he was suffering this terrible back injury. To this day, the mystery remains, and he just stopped the argument and just said, well, let's fix the problem, because I'm in pain, and is going to the doctor for his bad back. But there is absolutely no reason why it happened, why he has this terrible injury, other than putting it with these other strange events. I feel it's very, I said it to him kidding, hoping, you know, I said, I don't think you transport well. And he laughed and immediately knew what I meant. But it's very, very common in the people I talk to who have had strange experiences and lost time and possible abduction experiences, that they have an injury, an ailment, a bad rash, a bad burn, or just become very sick after the event. So when he told me about this, I really got quite concerned for him, and I've talked to him, you know, openly and very strongly about being very careful about where he goes and what he does from now on.
Those are very good points, and I have a very interesting question from our virtual auditorium chat room on Pal Talk. But just a very quick question on this here. The article references the very severe injury to the spinal vertebrae suffered by this individual. Also, Chris, have you heard many reports of a severe flu or cold reaction soon after an abduction?
Yes. I would say, geez, there's only a few people that I have not talked to that I truly believe had some type of experience that did not come back from it or wake up from it or over the next few days have a bad flu-like. They're nauseous, they're vomiting, they may have the runs, they have fevers, and they're sick for a week or two afterwards. Absolutely, yes.
Boy, that's intriguing. Now, I've got an interesting question from one of our area members, Gilly Mann. He often has very astute comments here. He wonders, he has a friend or he knows someone who sees orbs, but he doesn't. Why is that, Chris?
Well, if by orbs he means he sees little white orbs that are floating around the house, I'll be honest with you, I don't know too many people that I can pin something to that or have really investigated it. The orbs I'm talking about are large objects out in the sky. The smallest orb I have written about is probably the size of a garbage can cover, up to bigger than that, and they do change shape. Small little white orbs that people say they see in their yards and have pictures of, I don't know what that is. So without knowing what I'm talking about, I'm not going to make a statement about it. I don't know what that is. And I don't even, you know, I have no idea what's going on with that.
Well, thank you. No, I always appreciate frankness, and you're right, there is a question there as to whether or not it's the orbs that appear in photos or the orbs, the actual craft that look like some type of probe or can appear to be some type of probe, according to some opinions. Now, you know, you study the abduction phenomenon. You've written excellent articles. Now, you've also formed a real-time abductee group with the encouragement of a very unusual lady, an abductee, whose traits, for example, poor eyesight in the light, and an unusually gifted intellect and great psychic ability, reportedly were caused at least in part by her years of encounters with aliens. Your article's entitled The Most Unusual Abductee.
Yes. and I still see that group all the time or have contact with them. The reason for it, well, it took a long time for me to talk to each one of these people and, you know, just the logistics of it and getting together. And it took a very long time. And I'm very blessed and fortunate that when I did see them, they would talk to me literally for hours. And lots of things that people wanted me to ask them or find out were not the material I was given. Many of the questions I've asked that group, frankly, that are, how can I put it, mainstream paranormal ideas, laughed at, I mean, belly laughed at, where I felt foolish by this group of people. They're very unusual, and that woman is by far the most different human being I've ever had the pleasure of knowing, although sometimes it's you're a little frightened by someone so different. But she has a lot to say on many, many subjects, and it's not only that she has trouble with her eyes. She cannot be out in the sun any longer. She is covered with a strange skin on her legs and on, I think it's her chest, I saw it on. She's very unusual. She has incredibly light blue eyes, and she's brilliant, and she is blunt. So there's if you ask her a question, she's going to give you the answer, and I would say chances are most people in the paranormal would not like the answers. But, yeah, I still talk to her, and I'm going to interview them all again very soon. The summer is the best time to travel for all of us, of course. And I will be talking to them and writing more about them.
Well, you know, I was very moved by this article. This lady, despite her trials, remains very focused and intelligent. But you mentioned, Chris, she also has a number of bandages. She was wearing a number of bandages. She has scars. She really has had to face quite a bit. And also, you know that she believes her abductors may be a future form of human, and that their agenda here is for their benefit and not ours. Now, that sounds like something Joe Montalda would say, our expert here at ICAR. We have many experts. He is our international director. But that's interesting. Their agenda here is for their benefit and not ours.
Well, again, all the abductees I've ever talked to, first of all, I'm very, very picky. I don't talk to anyone that has had a dream encounter or under hypnotism. I have nothing to do with any of that. That is not my forte. Mine is people that were walking along their normal life in real time, doing their everyday business, and something encountered them and took them and then returned them. So they were fully awake when these things started. Most of them do not remember any of the actual event of being alone with these things, and do remember coming back where they were, how, you know, where they were put back, and that type of thing. There is spot memory of some of the things that went on for them, but most of all, these people were fully awakened and knew what was happening. That's number one. Now, the second thing is that out of every person I've written about, talked to, or interviewed, including this group of real-time abductees, not one of them ever thought that what was going on was for the benefit of mankind in any way. None of them believe that aliens are here for our benefit, to fix the planet, to help the planet. It is all self-agenda for the aliens. They use us exactly like we use rats, monkeys, dogs, cats, whatever we use in our experiments. That's how we are dealt with. We are not considered a being on the same level as they are, that's for sure. And why they want us, that's a question. I personally think, and so do many of the people that I talk to, it's strictly for something in our biological makeup. So they either need pieces of our DNA or pieces of our whatever, our biology, which may have stalled for them or be a problem for them. But besides that, they don't care about us. We're quite primitive and you know, wild to them. I mean, here's beings that travel the cosmos that take an conquered energy and know how to use it, visiting a planet where all we do is think up ways to kill ourselves and can't get off our own planet. And you know, that's not the highest level on the ladder of the cosmic neighborhood, I'm sure. So my answer is no, none of them think that they're here for us. They come here or pass by or swoop us up now and then for them.
Very powerful arguments there, Chris. Now I have another question from our audience from one of our Upper Midwest directors. He wants to know, Chris, if you know Elaine Douglas. She's a very powerful spokeswoman for rights of abductees. I believe, like myself, she thinks that there might be a human rights violation component of some of these activities. She was the former Utah director for MUFON, I believe. What do you think on that? Do you know Elaine Douglas? She's a very powerful advocate of experiencer rights.
I know who she is, yes.
Mm-hmm. And, well, that was his question. Now, I want to reference as well for our audience your article, Chris, the levels, quote, the levels of UFO alien encounters, end quote, where you further describe the types of encounters, types of abductions, the variety of after effects after an abduction, the possible reasons for abduction and abduction, the possible reasons for abduction, and also such aspects as implants, scarring, missing fetus syndrome, so forth, or missing fetus aspect. You also note the group Finding the Truth on UFOs with the principal Ed Fleming. Any comments on that? Very helpful article.
I wrote down, you know, everything I could come up with from the people I've talked to, why so many people experience these events. They are not, you know, pleasant by any chance. They invade your life, whether you want them or not. It's a kidnapping. And then while they have you, they invade your body, whether you like it or not, and do with what they will. I do know that they are very, as I said, interested in our chemistry, our body chemistry, our flesh and blood. I also know that, and I've read this many other places, so it's nothing that's new, you know, by way of me, but many people that are involved in these events have Rh negative blood. Everyone that I've talked to does. I find that extremely interesting, since the population, I think, has at whole is like 3 or 6% only that have Rh negative blood, yet all the abductions, the people largely have Rh negative blood. So there's something to that, as well as why they keep returning and using the same people. I personally think once you tag an animal and have their, you know, DNA sequence and everything else they might need, it may be easier, just simply easier, to keep taking them and using their material because they already have it programmed for what they want to use it for. I think it's kind of almost that simple. As far as fetuses missing, unfortunately that's true in a lot of cases that I've been told. Not only fetuses missing or people knowing they're pregnant, more so I've had 4 women, abductees, tell me they've had the unpleasant experience of being told by their gynecologist, because they developed problems, that they had been pregnant like 3 or 4 times in their life, when some of these women have never been pregnant at all that they knew of, never had a child, never gave birth. Others maybe had 1 or 2 children. One poor woman was accused of being like a monster, that she had so many, they told her, abortions, and the girl never had not one. So these strange aspects of these cases thread through them all, and, you know, obviously is part of what they're being used for.
And, of course, that's a tremendous violation. And you reference in your articles, too, that intrusive nature, the intrusive aspect of these visitations, or at least some of these visitations. Now, you know, One thing I came upon your article, I was just totally fascinated. This was it was written, the article is entitled "The Continued Mystery of the Blackout of 1965 and the Fireball."
Oh, yeah.
And Chris, you mentioned seeing the night of the blackout, yes. November 9th, 1965,
right.
A large fireball fall to the earth. The very day of the Northeast blackout, you saw this with your friend, but what's very interesting as well, you received several items from correspondence, several communications that other people in this area saw that large fireball.
Well, it was a large fireball, and it didn't fall to the earth. It streaked across as a ship or a comet, but it was not a comet. It was a large, round, burning object, and I mean large. It looked like the moon going across the sky. And it had a fire, a tail of fire, because it was on fire. And it streaked at enormous speed. It looked to me like a craft that was on fire, like a huge, huge, huge ship. And it streaked across the sky. And we looked at this thing, and my friend said the only thing that comes to your mind is what you know of to reference to. She said, that must be a comet that's going to hit the Earth. And we were so dumb, if something that size would have hit the planet, we would have been in tremendous trouble. And it streaked across, and from where I was sitting, looked as if it went out into the Atlantic Ocean. Now, I wrote that article because that really stayed with me my whole life. I will never forget that. And then the blackout was huge and, you know, caused turmoil, and our parents were all, you know, setting fires in the fireplace to make coffee or whatever. It was a very, you know, a moment in life you don't forget about, a big blackout like that. And I wrote about it, and not only did I get a few emails, I got hundreds and hundreds of emails from people who live now all over the world that read that article and said to me, I lived on the East Coast of the United States and saw it too. Not only did they tell me they saw the same exact fireball, other people saw fleets of UFOs, they tell me. Some had abduction experiences. Others claimed to have seen crafts that were landed. Many saw single UFOs flying in their neck of the woods, but hundreds saw the same fireball, and they all, every single, even talking about it. And the reason for this, the people that obviously were outside were the younger kids, I feel. All the older people were inside during that blackout period. The teenagers and the kids that were outside all saw this and all remembered it. And it's just fascinating to me that obviously something huge occurred and it just got swept right under the carpet.
And you know, very interestingly enough, there's been discussion at all levels of this important connection between, or of a reported connection between UFOs and the Great Northeast Blackout of November 9th, 1965. For example, Chris, researcher Preston Dennett, in his book entitled UFOs Over New York, A True History of Extraterrestrial Encounters in the Empire State, end quote, references testimony by Dr. James McDonald before the House Committee on Science and Astronautics of the connection between the New York blackout and reports of UFOs.
Absolutely. I think it's to the point now they just, you know, cannot keep saying, oh, no, oh, no. Oh, yes. And people from, you know, top to bottom of North America saw it happen. And now it's, I guess, maybe even more, I don't know what's the word, feasible to talk about it without being maybe ridiculed and laughed to death, because at that time, I don't remember it being a subject that was too openly spoken about. But believe me, that thing was there, and it was on fire, and I think it was still under control, whatever it was, and trying to maintain control, or it ditched in the Atlantic Ocean, or was able to shoot back into space. I don't know. But it certainly existed and was there, and it caused that blackout. But blackouts and UFOs, I think, go hand in hand and have for a very long time now. I wrote another article about a feeding UFO, which a group of hunters I know were out on Long Island in the woods, and they became aware of their surroundings, that a blackout was happening in the neighborhood where they had left their trucks and everything. And as they walked into the woods during this little blackout, they came upon a huge UFO, dark black, over a tower of a radio tower, a cell phone tower, and a electric wire tower thing where they had all the big transmitters, not
transponders. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. A whole group, a big LIPA grouping of these big towers for the electric, and next to it, what just so happened, they also used that land to put the cell phone tower, which is not popular here, and a radio transmitting tower. And over it was this huge UFO with a laser beam down into the towers. The men saw this and frantically turned around and ran back to their trucks. When they went back into their trucks, the blackout flickered and the lights all went back on in the area, and that was it. So obviously this thing was disturbing the area's energy, you know, grid. So I think that, I don't think they use it for fuel. I think that's totally ridiculous. It's so antique and impractical for them. But I do think that they have a fascination with being in our wires to either upload or download possibly into them, or something of that nature. But they are constantly hanging around our grid.
Very interesting. You know, I have heard of different researchers referencing UFOs in their proximity to utility plants and other facilities. Now, Chris, here I want to reference a fascinating article that you have written about the reported November 1992 crash in South Haven Park in Suffolk County, New York. Now, your article is entitled, How Quickly We Forget the UFO Crash, South Haven Park, New York, 1992. This reportedly was quite the UFO crash.
That's another interesting thing. And, you know, I think the people on Long Island have just gotten so used to being ridiculed, laughed at, or overlooked with paranormal sightings, that they don't get all in an uproar anymore. And I say that because this is the land of Plum Island, and we had Camp Hero in full blast for many, many years. Brookhaven Lab is here. We're an island that sticks out into the Atlantic Ocean, so you get a lot of activity. And people who live on Long Island often see things that are unexplained and unknown. So we take things, I think, a little bit too blasé, in a blasé matter at times. One of them was the 92 crash in that park. That the gentleman I talked to, he saw it happened. So did his neighbors. So did, as time went on, other people I know that lived out in that area. All witnessed that thing come flying in and crash into that park. Yet, it just was controlled and able to get again swept under the carpet without too much of a big deal made out of it. However, the people in Long Island did try to bring it out, did try to get it into the papers more than it did make it, did try to talk about it, and it was just pounded down and forgotten. But this man lived close to the park, and he was, let's say, a survival type of guy. Instead of me calling him a cheap gentleman, I'm going to say he was a survival type. He did not work much. Instead, he took from the land, which means he would climb the fences at night and go into his neighbor's yards that had gardens and steal their vegetables and go into the park where he was not supposed to be and shoot the duck and shoot a deer and drag it out and go in there and collect wood and do all things he wasn't supposed to survive in his little, like, cabin-like house. And just was very proud of the fact that, like, he could have people for dinner and kill a couple of ducks and, you know, steal all the vegetables from his neighbors and give a dinner party. So be it. That was his character. He's no longer with us. What can I say? However, the one night that he was in the park to collect wood, he saw that saucer come blasting over his head, and not only saw it, but heard it crash. Not only did he hear it crash, which he said was more like a loud thump than a huge explosion, but extremely loud, he heard something or people or something screaming and yelling right afterwards for a while, and then the woods go silent. This terrified this man, just terrified him. He got out of the woods, out of the park, couldn't start his truck right away, finally got himself back home, locked himself in with his guns and everything he needed, while he then witnessed military, fire department, police departments blasting down with their trucks into the park. So, you know, he also then went about telling us how he was told to stay out of there and stay in his house and, you know, just mind his own business. And in about, I think he said it was a week or so later, when they opened the park, he took and looked in and he said it was not even the same place anymore. It looked like they vacuumed the woods. It had been totally cleared of even, you know, twigs and leaves and everything. So whatever crashed in there was picked up and removed, and they just basically told the people in the area to shut up and stay out of the way. And no, you didn't see anything. That was very frustrating to me because I knew the chief of one of the fire departments out there. It just so happened I grew up with him. And when I tried to talk to him about this event, for the first and only time in his life, we had a very good relationship. He got a little cold and nasty to me. And I didn't have to go any further. I knew that it had happened by his reaction. Otherwise, he would have acted like that with me. So, again, we have an enormous event that happened, and how can you say they got away with it? It was concealed, it was controlled, and nobody talks about it anymore.
An event that becomes a non-event,
right.
And it does sound as though that there was a definite intimidation factor. Now, I've got a great question on ascension, but I just wanted to reference to it another article you had written, or I'm sorry, this article, this segment rather, is a continuation of that fascinating article about the Canadian wilderness, the sighting of that individual with his friends in Canada. It mentions the account of a dedicated skeptic from the New Haven, Connecticut area. You mentioned, Chris, that in August of this past year, after purchasing a fast food dinner for his family, the man with his wife and teenage children went to the West Haven, Connecticut marina shore to eat their food in a beautiful landscape, scenic landscape. They observed a large UFO over the water at about 7 p.m., and others in the area, too, also observed this. And the family arrived home, but they may have had quite a significant segment of missing time. They didn't arrive home until about approximately 10:30 p.m.
Yeah, this was the one report that, after dealing with this gentleman, and again, I know him through another brother of mine who also lives in the New Haven, Connecticut area, and this man is an educated man. He's a college professor who witnessed this UFO. After talking to him, I wanted to come home and bang my head on the wall until I knocked myself out because he was incredible the way he was in full denial, yet telling me right to my face that he had probably one of the most clear, detailed UFO sightings of anybody. You know, few people see it as clearly as this guy. He would not accept it. I don't know if his denial, it was out of pure fear or what, but they definitely saw a huge UFO. he could detail the windows and the different colors and the different neon lights and how it would change and how you could look into the lights, and they were so bright they should hurt your eyes, but they didn't. And they were so beautiful that they were captivating and give you details of his sighting, but then tell you what he thinks it was, and he would come up with anything he could think of other than a craft from another place. He was determined to rationalize this as a black ops program and something that we have, and could not explain why it came out of the clouds, why it then disappeared in front of his face, or, you know, any of that. He just wouldn't discuss it. The 3 hours, and I think it was even a little over 3 hour time difference that his family had from 7 p.m. to after 10 p.m., he just couldn't figure that out, so he insisted that they didn't pick up the burgers at 7. It must have been like 5 minutes to 9, where it was still a little bit light outside, and then immediately got dark. And that it was really, which still would give him an hour, like an hour and a half of lost time, but he just would not calmly accept the fact that maybe he had 3 hours he couldn't remember and didn't know what happened. He was frantic about it. When someone is that frightened, it is my opinion you don't push them. So I just let him talk and decided to just write the article as he told it to me and leave him with whatever belief he needs to hold to what happened to him. Because, let's face it, he's the person that had the encounter, not me. But it was a brilliant encounter. The man, in my mind, saw a fantastic UFO that possibly had been cloaked and maybe dropped their cloaking and didn't even realize it, or dropped down to play with them and let them take a look and then snatch them. I don't know. I know all these things happen, but I don't know exactly what happened to him other than he lost 3 hours of time with his total family and saw a huge UFO. So that was, but this man is such a skeptic. I'm amazed he even admitted it to me, told, and again, all of it I think was out of fear. He wanted to see my reaction, and I had to be very careful not to terrify this man too much.
Well, it was very professionally done, and I've noticed in your articles as well, Chris, that you are particularly impressed by the abduction and observation accounts that don't become too florid, not overly filled with excessive details that give the chronological events and the important results or reactions. Now, I've got that wonderful question. I'm going to ask it in a minute, but I wanted to reference a sighting on March 9th of this year that you, your brother, and other witnesses witnessed in a shopping area in Northport, New York. You saw an oval, bright white in color. It was moving in the sky towards the direction of the water. It stopped, hovered, and then resumed flight toward Long Island Sound. Any new developments on that? Any further sightings of such a craft?
No, no. Not that I've been told or written to or called about. And trust me, people, they email me and they call me and they do whatever they need to tell me, but no. And it was interesting because when we were watching that, there were other people watching it, too. And as well as that being, you know, very clear in my mind, remembering that, I also remember the people around me eating ice cream that didn't miss a lick. I mean, that it didn't, I don't know if they're unaware of what these things possibly could be or just totally accepting of it and, oh, well, there's, you know, UFO or what. But there were other people around that looked up, watched it, stood there, and then just continued eating their ice cream and walking away. So that was interesting on many levels, that sighting. You know, first, of course, I was looking at something I didn't know what it was, and secondly, how the people around me react. That never ceases to amaze me.
Right, the sociocultural response.
Right.
Perhaps those people did want to have their paradigm of reality terribly impacted, and really noticing it as sharply as they should have been.
Because my normal reaction to the unknown is to scream like a little girl and run as fast as I can, screaming the whole way to safety. That's my reaction to the unknown, and my reaction is because I've had to deal with it face-to-face, alone in the night. So my reaction is safety first. But you don't see that in people. And, of course, I have to understand a lot of these people have not had to deal alone with a lost time experience or an object that they didn't know what it was or anything like that. So they don't have the natural fear they should. But I would think anything that you don't know what it is, your natural inbred reaction would be for your, you know, hair to go up and on the back of your neck and for you to be very careful. But I don't see that in people. I don't know if it's the way to keep themselves intact, as you say, and just deny it. I don't know if it's too much Star Wars and Star Trek over the years and they became numb, or that the, you know, powers that be did a good job and have made them think, well, these things are ridiculous or explainable, or it's all a military black ops program. I don't know. But I do know they don't react like I do.
And probably one should observe, one should take precautions, and one should, as you note in so many of your articles, be aware, remain aware, do take precautions, be a keen observer of the world around you.
Absolutely.
And everything occurring around you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, at all times. And if you are all alone in the dark and you're not sure what you're walking into, do yourself a favor, don't walk into it. Whatever's there, you can see it in the daylight, do it in the daylight, or go get other people to do it with. But never set yourself up to be taken. It's just a foolish thing to do. And if you see a creature, you're saying, is that a human? What is that thing standing over there? Don't walk over to take a look. Don't offer yourself up. Run back, get help. Call the local authorities if you're alone. Turn all the lights on. Make everything as lit as you possibly can and call for help. But do not offer yourself up. It may be the last thing you do. You know, not everyone is returned from a lost time experience or an abduction. And that's something you should never forget. So protection first, being careful, being smart, and doing, you know, the right thing for you and your family, which is not to place yourself in danger you can't handle.
Well said. Now, Chris, I have a question here from our Midwest, Upper Midwest director. Now, we have about 3 minutes left, and perhaps you might want to continue it, but it's an interesting question. He wonders that does some believe, supposedly, the human race is in the process of ascension. He wonders what you think the purpose is for the aliens attempting to create hybrids. What could the possible purposes for these hybrid creatures be? Do you have theories on this?
Yeah, I do. It's a good question, too. I think, first of all, you have to remember there's not one set of aliens. There's many different types of aliens. And I think they all do things for it's all their own agenda. But they all do things differently, you know, from each other. Hybrids, I don't understand quite what they are unless it's an attempt for them to utilize our planet in a better way for themselves. Not for us. We are not the main concern. I do not, wholeheartedly, do not believe the aliens care much at all what happens to us as a civilization. It's our job to climb the rung. It's our job to be better beings. It's our job to evolutionize our society, to stop killing and stop all the things we do. It's our job how to learn to be a planet in a cosmos full of planets. and stop being such, you know, tribal, warlike, killing creatures. That's all our job, not theirs to do for us. We're not their concern. I think they've already been that road. It's our job to do it for ourselves in our time, our way. Why they're doing experiments like that, it could be for many reasons, and I don't think any of them are too good, not for mankind. I do think they're trying to use what the biological material is a reasoning. Maybe if they make hybrids, they can then use them or mate them to, you know, have takeout on the go so they can have that genetic material with them wherever they go and not need one of us so much if they can have part of us, which would be in a hybrid.
Very interesting points there, Chris. Now, everyone, we're about to take a 10-minute break. During this interim, I just wanted to note again the webpage for Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website, endlessjrny.blogspot.com, and the sister site to Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website, which contains additional articles, news, and videos as well, and that can be found at chrishawley2.blogspot.com. Now, let me see here. We have about half a second. Chris, when we return, I'd love to discuss more of your articles on UFOs, aliens, also interesting ghostly events, and your very intriguing and philosophic comments about this era of 2012 that we're in.
Yes.
And we'll be right back. Everyone, join us back in 10 minutes.
Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to A Global Focus with guest Chris Hawley, writer and researcher on paranormal and contemporary topics, and creator of Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website. To our discussion, to our interview with Chris Hawley. Chris, of course, is a writer and researcher on paranormal contemporary topics, and her two websites, Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website and sister site. Now, I have a question for you, Chris. There are several reports there of so many abductees wanting to communicate with you, their accounts, their ongoing reports of contact or experiences. Why do they choose you?
That is a question, and I would like to answer this question. This is very interesting to me. They did choose me. I did not choose them. I was writing because of my own experience in life with the different things, and they were looking for someone to write about their experiences, but they could not find anyone that they felt was truthful. The reason that the most unusual, that brilliant woman, picked me was because of a rash on my leg. She has the same skin doctor that I do. And he said to me one day, "Are you still writing about that nonsense?" Well, of course, right away, I took a, you know, please don't, you know, you don't want to believe, fine, but don't come at me like that. And I said, yes. And he just said, "This woman wants to talk to you." I called the woman and found out it was the most unusual abductee. She also has the same exact skin condition I have. She then told me that the reason that they wanted someone like me is because they will only talk to another abductee, another lifelong experiencer, someone who has faced the unknown and someone who has fully seen a UFO and has been taken. Well, to be honest, I've been taken since I'm three, and I've had terrible, terrible encounters and experiences my entire life. With that knowledge, they wanted to talk to me. The first go-around I had with these people, these abduction group, which they found each other, I'm not even sure. Every time I ask for the, really, how'd they get together, I get, you know, a little different stories, but it's fine, they know each other. Is they cross-questioned me about my entire life. And after they did that and were comfortable with me, they then told me, okay, you can start to write this stuff. And that's how I came about meeting with them. And it's in the summers, as I said, because some of them have to travel. And the most unusual abductee is very successful in keeping herself in a protected hermit-type life. And she fixes a place for us to meet safely and discuss these things, and that is how I was brought into this group. It's because of my own personal part of it.
Well, I can tell from your writings, your observations, you're an extremely empathic and eloquent journalist. I continue to find both your blog websites extremely helpful. And you know, Chris, one article that I really felt, it struck a chord, but it really was just so moving, for me anyway, it's your article entitled Thrown Back Without Concern, Another Abductee Speaks Out. It concerns a friend who introduced you to an individual named Brian, a veteran,
yes,
who had begun to endure terrifying abductions as a young child. For example, he remembers screaming for help at the beginning of these abductions and being paralyzed. His father remembers hearing screams, but being paralyzed and physically unable to come to the aid of a screaming child.
Yes.
Now, this individual, Brian, remains highly bright and creative, but he has had difficulties in life. For example, his first wife wondered why he had bruises in the groin area.
Right.
Also, and his first wife thought he was having, an affair. And, you know, Chris, in your articles, you describe how Brian and other abductees have gone through so much at the hands of their abductors and are yet not appreciated by their community. It's as though they are victimized twice.
Yes, absolutely. It's just like being kidnapped, abused, beaten, possibly raped, and then sent back for your family to criticize, ridicule, and your neighborhood to laugh at you. There's absolutely no difference. So you are kidnapped, abused, and then returned to be tortured by your own kind. There is nothing nice about this scenario, which is why I type and type and type and beg people, please, be careful. You do not want to go look for this. You do not want this. You don't want to end up like this. You hear my vocal cords? They get paralyzed on and off, and have since I'm about 5 years old, where I can't control them. Nobody can explain to me why. It's part of what has happened to me, and that's the good part. Trust me, I have some serious wounds of my own. But Brian broke my heart. Brian is still in his early 40s, and he was really, really abused. His whole stomach and digestive system was destroyed. His insides are like that of a 90-year-old. He had no chance in life at all. They were brutal with him. Nobody cared about Brian, so when they returned him, they threw him back like a sack of rags. And his life has been really, really, really tough. But he hangs in there, and he's very smart. And he teaches himself, like, how to build computers or how to do beautiful graphic art and things like that so that he can survive. But out of all of us, I think he was really, really treated badly by whatever took him.
You know, another haunting article that you've written, Chris, is the one entitled The Abductee Symbol, The Ongoing Mystery. And it references an experiencer who would continue to draw a symbol first learned as a 3-year-old child when he was still draw it at the age of 60 on papers, notepads, and books, although he had prevented from drawing the symbol at school and probably during his life, during his work, his employment. And Chris, I was wondering, has anyone written in saying that they too have seen this type of figure drawn by that experiencer? It just was a very moving account of how the abduction experiences strongly impact or can impact a person's life.
No, you know, people wrote in and they would, you know, it's very easy to take a 6 point of anything and pull a design out of it, but no one has ever given or found that exact symbol made in one line without taking the pen from the paper. And it is based on, obviously, nature's perfect shape. It's has six points to it. However, the abductee that has been doing this compulsively since a small child certainly didn't know geometry at the time and to this day cannot stop drawing this thing. It's all over notepads and everything else. The abductee is a woman, and she does know it's her tag, her name, where she came from or something like that. It's an identity thing for her, which maybe when they tagged her, that was given as her symbol, you know, like we do with chemicals or something. But no, she searches, I search, nothing.
Very, very intriguing. Now, you know, Chris, I think another point, but you may already have referenced this, you strongly believe in the full spectrum of alien life, the diversity of life throughout the universe.
Right.
You think that really one of our tasks here during this existence is to find out as much as we can about the universe or the multiverses and to just really become absorbed in learning as much as possible.
Yes. Without question, I know that I thought, you know, everyone felt the same way that I did. You'd want to know why you're here, what you're supposed to do, and where you're going to go. I mean, isn't everyone caught up in that? I used to read a book a day at one point in my life. I was so overcome with all of this, trying to find the answers, and of course I went to school and I've been educated and blah, 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 all of that.
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, I think my conclusion, and this is just personally mine, is we're here to do the best we can with this trip through with our energy in this human form. And that is, I think, where a lot of people get caught up and angry at me. They don't want to hear that, because doing the best you can and the right thing all the time is a burden. It's very hard. It's not easy to always do the right thing in a circumstance when maybe it's not the perfect thing for you. Or it's maybe a hard thing not to be mean-spirited. So many mean-spirited, nasty, mean people out there. Or killing isn't maybe the first answer to everything. Being the best being you can, that sounds ridiculous, but, you know, being the best you can be in this life form, I think, is your main job. And from there, your energy will go where it will go after you've accomplished that. And if it's too much work for you and you haven't done that, or you refuse to do that, or you don't believe in that, chances are you might make a few trips around to a similar place, if not this planet, again. And I do believe there's many other places like this for us to encounter and experience as our energy, spirit, or whatever you want to think of it as, you know, is let loose in this tremendous cosmos. I don't think it's just a mistake. I don't think it's just by chance. I don't think it's without meaning. I think it all is very planned and very carefully laid out. So I try very hard to, you know, do the best I can. And unfortunately, we're all human. We all make mistakes and we all have shortcomings. But unless you know that, I think you're going to be stuck, in one place for a long time.
Beautifully said. You know, those concepts really are very strongly reflected in your article entitled, What If It Is All About the Soul? And in that article, you really reference the importance of learning, appreciating everything we can about the universes, and the personal reasons and goals for our existence. It's beautifully said. And, you know, Krish, you really bring that, too, to the article, Living in the Era of 2012. You discuss the various challenges. You don't anticipate the Earth's final days, but am I correct here? You foresee the possibility of various challenges in the environment, weather, return of cyclical upheavals in nature, and other factors?
Absolutely. I think I don't think the world is going to end. The world hasn't ended yet. However, it did go through some terrible, terrible problems, and it's going to again. And guess what? It's time for us to go through them now. So I think the message that our ancestors was trying to, you know, leave for us, or prophets that were seeing these things happen, is that we are part of the plan. And like it or not, it's not always a beautiful day. And that we're going to have some very tough times. And just like in Japan, or in India, when there was that massive tsunami there that killed so many people, people are going to die. There are going to be massive events that kill many humans, and it's a horrible thing, but it's time. It's time for our volcanoes to erupt. It's time for huge earthquakes to take place. It's time for many things that we don't want to happen to happen. So the best is try to prepare to survive it. And leave out, forget, what about the sun? What about our antique electrical grids and energy grids? What about all that stuff that is so primitive and so broken down and fragile that could be hit? Do you know what a catastrophe it would be if we lost our energy grid in the United States and North America? I mean, the economy would collapse. It would just be terrible. You would go overnight back to a horse and wagon and fire. You know, can anybody survive like that? We have to think about these things. And instead of the fantasy of, you know, some of the things I read, they just infuriate me. They're so ridiculous. Instead of a total ridiculous concept, think more pragmatically and think that these other things, which are just as terrible and just as deadly, are going to come, and we have to learn how to deal with it. And by doing that and being able to survive maybe just a few weeks in your own home or on your own land, whatever it is you need to do, that could be the difference between survival and death. Because if you don't take care of yourself until others can get there to help you, you're going to perish. And I try to, you know, to get that across. Yes, we're in a very dangerous era, but this era was going to come no matter what. And in thousands and thousands and thousands of years from now, they're going to come again. It's part of nature. It's part of this planet's nature. It's part of our galaxy's nature, this universe's nature. And we have to ride with it. Not try to ignore it or fight against it.
That's very well said, and that importance there of being proactive in proper preparation. Very good points there. Now, Chris, I want to return to one of our opening subjects, that being orbs. And we have a very insightful member here of our audience, VZE33. He's wondering if from any of your accounts or any of the communications or emails you receive from abductees, have you ever heard of orbs trying to instruct or teach individuals, impart information? Have they taught you or others anything or any type of information being passed from orbs to humans?
Orbs?
Yes.
The only thing I know about orbs is they make you pass out cold. And you don't know what happened to you till you wake up on the other end. That's the only thing I know about orbs. And that they are usually, if they're the big ones that, like, follow you in the car or out in your yard. The large ones, you need to be careful. They are attached somehow to lost time or abduction. They definitely, I would say, that happens. As far as orbs giving information, no. Never even had that brought up. I never heard it before. Definitely not of any, out of any of the abductees. I know the abduction people I know have strong emotions and feelings about subjects and an understanding. It's almost like whatever is done, I think, to transport them, whatever is done to wipe their memory from what happens to them also turns on something in the abduction people that their IQ points increase. And I think it's just a side effect of what's done to them. I don't think it's meant in any shape or form. And with that comes some of the memory of the feelings and emotions of these other beings towards us. And that's clear. And that's been clear to everyone. And but as far as trying to teach us and all that, we've not had that experience, no.
Thank you for that answer. Now, Chris, in your writings, you indicate that aliens visiting the Earth may be clothed in such a degree of protective gear that we really aren't viewing them as they truly appear. You introduced this in your article, this concept in your article, Aliens, What Do They Look Like? Interesting article. It again references the great diversity of planetary systems in the universe and proposes that aliens would reflect that diversity.
Absolutely. I think aliens come in many forms. I think some of the crafts we see are probably part biology, part machine, so that you have a living type craft visiting us. I think maybe there are others that are all androids, they're just robotic people that are not not living beings, that they're just machines that are doing the work of another, of the beings for them. I think that there are other aliens visiting us that are pure energy, and maybe to interact with us are in suits. And I think a lot of the descriptions of aliens are beings that are in protective suits. We couldn't just planet and breathe and survive. We'd have to be in a spacesuit. Well, what makes you think that they could come here and just walk around? I'm sure there are some that do, or some that are altered to do it, or others that are in fake human suits to survive and interact with us. But I do think that most of it is protective space gear, or part machine, part organic. And I do believe that there are aliens that have evolved to the point or ahead of us to the point where they're just pure energy and don't actually have a body form.
Boy, that's a very intriguing diversity there. Very intriguing. And, you know, the elements are very credible. You know, the points of your argument, they are very, very credible. Now, in your article, Are UFOs Alive?, you referenced the fact that UFOs can appear alive, they can appear to be a symbiotic craft, and there have been reports of morphing craft. In fact, I think there's a YouTube video somewhere on one of your sites about a morphing craft. Now, this concept of a UFO, Chris, being both a machine and a living creature, a type of hybrid, is really haunting. But you reference our society's steps toward the merger of biology with mechanism.
Absolutely. That's where you're going to go. Is that where you want to go? I want to hold on to humanity as long as I can. I'm not quite ready to give it up to being part machine. I'm not ready to give it up to be controlled as a machine. I would like, you know, us to go a little longer, become the best human beings we can before we give it over. I personally don't think that we are civilized enough to get into that as soon as we are. I think we're way ahead of ourselves. We have to learn how to get along on this planet before we start interjecting machinery and computers into our biology. So I am completely against it. At this point in history and this point in time, I just don't think we are ready, and that we're missing too many steps in between being a human and being a hybrid machine robot part biology being.
The importance of humanity and the importance really of appreciating what should be humanity's rightful sovereignty on the earth, appreciating all the aspects of being human. Now, Chris, I'm about to transition here into your other paranormal research, but I didn't want to forget your article, The Hum. You returned to a subject that you first wrote on at least 2 years ago, the fact that the Long Island coast is still beset by intermittently hearing that hum. What are the possible theories for it? Could there be an underground facility connection or beneath the water surface connection there out in the sound? Given that your homes are near the shore, you do mention the proximity of Brookhaven National Laboratory and I guess the relativistic heavy ion collider. What do you think?
I think, well, in our case here, I think there's probably a lot of things causing these hums because they're heard all around. And people write to me all about it, too. That thing is driving me crazy because it turns on out of nowhere. And it sounds like a diesel truck running right out in your driveway and shakes your house. And you go out and there's nothing there, nothing to be found. And the hum is everywhere. And then just as fast as it starts, bang, it turns off. I spent enough time driving around in my car looking for this thing. And then my one son and his wife, live about a mile from me. And I often see them with their dogs riding around at night when you hear the hum, determined to find this thing. And we cannot find it. The conclusion I came to in my case is that I think the Long Island Sound, a body of water, large body of water between Long Island and Connecticut, is working almost as an amplifier or a muffler type thing. But I think the humming may be coming in our case from Brookhaven Lab when they spin that particle collider underneath the ground. I think it's like underneath the ground 5 miles or so around. It's huge. It was one of the biggest in the world until recently. And when they spin that thing, I think it vibrates and the Long Island Sound is somehow reacting to it and it produces or, you know, provides us this annoying hum. I can't think of much more than that. And the only other thing is that they're tunneling under us, which I don't think Long Island is even, I don't know if it's even capable that we could tunnel that deep underneath the land. I'm not sure. But it would be something, I think, from underneath that's vibrating up, causing this noise. And if it is the collider, I wish it'd stop. Because it just is a very eerie, dangerous feeling situation to be in.
You know, that's understandable, that feeling, that reaction. And yes, here I note in the article, it's referenced as the relativistic heavy ion collider.
Right.
My pronunciation sometimes. The relativistic heavy ion collider and your ion collider and your article's entitled The Hum. Well, that's fascinating.
Yes. And I wonder also if other people that are hearing this hum have similar labs or even military installations around them that they could, you know, look at and say, what are they really doing there? And do we really, you know, need that done so close to a big population? But that would be my idea. And my answer to those questions, yes. Governments, labs, the powers that be do dangerous things in the middle of places you'd never anticipate they would, and they do it regularly. So, as I say, be aware of what's going on around you.
Well said. Indeed, is the risk worth the benefit?
Right.
Now, let's go. You've also done some really interesting research on the subject of ghosts. And there was one article that just really intrigued me. That was entitled The Spirits at Sally's House. Now, I remember our first interview about 2 years ago, an interesting discussion on ghost research, that there's several haunted sites there, on Long Island. But now, in this 2012 article, The Spirits at Sally House, you referenced that a friend of yours, and your, of you and your sister, you've known this lady, Sally, for many years, has lived in her childhood home through her marriage. Her parents had gifted the home to the young couple. Now, these spirits continue to allegedly advise the family by use of musical instruments and other modalities.
Yes. Yes. They do. And people say, I've had experiences there that are quite bizarre. And I think the one, I've had a lot of them over the years, was they have stringed instruments like banjos and guitars and I think violins and stuff displayed in their house as like artwork. And I've been there when they played while on the wall. And it wasn't just that the temperature changed and the strings, made a strum. They played a chord, I think it's what it's called. They played like a little tune. And everybody just stops talking, stops moving, and looks at each other in stunned silence. And then the family does this. I'm not good at this. They just backtrack to what they had just been talking about and relate that this interference is a message about whatever they were talking about or discussing. And take the advice. And to me, it's just... But I do know at one point in my life I was thinking about remarrying. I think I wrote about that.
Yes.
And I was discussing it, and I didn't know what to do and didn't know if it was a good idea, and I was discussing it over tea with my two friends. And a darling globed music box on the hutch in the dining room began to play. And it played this wonderful... It's some type of well-known wedding waltz. I forgot the exact name of it. But it's a waltz. And it's, I think, The Night We Were Wed. And it started playing this lovely little song. And I laughed at my friend and said, that was really cute. How'd you pull that off? To play exactly when I said to them, I don't know what to do. And they just looked at each other. And my one friend said to her sister, should we tell her? And she said, that wasn't us. That's one of my relatives, they think you should get married. And I said, what are you talking? They went over and they got the globe and they put it in front of me, the music box. And she said, turn it over. And I looked and it has to be wound. So I wound it up and put it down so that it could play the same song for me again. And it played, I think, Jingle Bells and Silent Night. So I tried to do it again and again. They said, stop. It only plays those two songs. That other song is not in there. Well, let me tell you, that took me back. It was startling. I just didn't know what to think of that. I tried to take that thing, I tried to look at it, take it apart. I wanted them to open it. It was just a Christmas ornament, what it turned out to be, with an angel inside of it to play two Christmas tunes. It had no waltzes in it.
Definitely an anomalous event there. Positive, but anomalous.
And by the way, I did get remarried, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life.
Excellent. That's a wonderful development. Well, you're a lovely lady, a fortunate husband, fortunate, and a wonderful couple there. Well, you know, Chris, on the other side of ghostly research, you, in an article, report the rather harrowing account of your young cousin while a teenager during a visit back in the mid-60s to an allegedly haunted mansion in a small Long Island town.
That was awful.
The article is entitled A Halloween Horror. Yes.
Yes. They learned a good lesson, and that's not to go look for it. Don't go look for trouble if you're not going to be able to handle it. And that this was teenagers, and they were out, and they went to... There was a church with a very old graveyard, and behind it a large mansion. And they were told by the townspeople to stay out of there, leave it alone, don't go there. And, of course, they did. And what they encountered was, I guess, something pretty much invisible beating the daylights out of them. And this thing attacked them behind the graveyard at the side of this old mansion, and it flew them in the air and hit them and bruised them and broke them and just beat the daylights out of them until they were able to make their way back into the graveyard, where other kids that were with them ran to the church where there was a new young minister there, came out and helped them, and needed to pray and bring holy water and do everything he could to save them. And they ended up in an ambulance at the hospital. They were so badly hurt. And that event taught them a good lesson and also made believers out of them, that there are things we don't understand that are unknown that you don't mess with for a good time. And certainly don't go looking for it if you don't know what you're doing. So there were a lot of lessons in that article.
It's a very powerful article. And indeed, one more time give the name of it, the title of it, A Halloween Horror, very well worth the read. But now here's another article that gives a different aspect of the haunting phenomena. It's a much more pleasant aspect. It's in your article entitled The Cop, The Ghost, and The Stranger, I believe is the title.
Yes.
It contains a fascinating account of a New York City policeman who may have had his life saved by a ghost.
Yes, and this man was a total skeptic. He is very snide and demeaning towards people in the paranormal. He will discuss it and everything, but behind their backs, he's quite a different animal. He really doesn't believe anything. And he had a terrible experience. He had two terrible experiences. One was in the woods, in the wilderness with some hunting friends, where they kept meeting up on this old logging road, this old man that would tip his hat, and walk by them, but not speak to them. They saw him, I think, twice on their hunting trip, going and coming, and when they got back to base camp and said to the people, you know, who is that old man that lives up there in the wilderness? They said, oh, that's that ghost, old Joe. Well, that was part of it, and he was shaken by that, but thought, nah, that's just an old man that lives up there. Then when he returned and was back in New York City on his beat, he got himself into a bad position where he was alone in an alley with a man that he could not handle, and started to have, you know, a conflict with the guy, and the man, the bad guy, was getting the better of this cop, and it looked like this cop was going to risk, his life was at risk, until this old man came walking into this dark alley out of nowhere, pushing a cart, and pushed the cart literally into the two struggling men, the cop and the bad guy. The big bad guy that was overpowering this cop. And he pushed his wig and knocked them apart and pushed them, and it gave the policeman the edge to get the upper hand in the situation and get his gun, I believe, and be able to hold the guy till others came. And when he looked at this old man, and he was stunned, he looked and it was old Joe. It was the man, the ghost from the logging road. And he could not explain it. And, of course, after the situation was in hand, he searched and had other policemen search the area for this old man, and they could not find anyone, no cart, no old man, nothing. So to this day, he now accepts the fact that either his guardian angel was this old Joe or something like that did occur. But he swears it was the same person on the logging road that they saw in the wilderness, and who saved his life in that alley.
You mentioned the eyes were extremely distinctive as well.
Right.
With this alleged entity. It sounds very interesting. And that entity was actually on a road there. Was it Montana? It was one of the western states near a mine in a forested area.
Yes. Yes. And it was closed down. I said logging. I think they're called logging. The roads they go in and out of the mines. I don't know what they're
called.
But it was they were all closed down, except for the hunters would take them up to go hunt whatever animal they were hunting at the time. And it wasn't just him. The whole group saw and said hello to this old man in and out of their, you know, hunting trip. And
yes.
He kept walking and just looked at them. I think he had the big blue eyes and didn't say a word to them. And they said he was solid. He looked like a human to them. But so did the old man with the cart that broke up the fight. That was the same person. So we'll never know what happened there. It's just lucky for him. It happened.
Absolutely. And is that's an interesting contrast to the entity first seen reportedly in that Montana locale and then saving his life in the Upper West Side in an alley. That's
yes.
really very, very intriguing.
Yes.
Now, you know, Chris, your research extends to many areas of the paranormal. I know back at your 2009 article, quote, The Thing on the Bridge, end quote, you referenced that Steve, the co-host of Nocturnal Frequency,
yes.
referenced observing a frightening creature, almost human in form, but definitely not a man. Now, one of my friends thinks that this might be Bigfoot, but he's not sure. Now, apparently Steve was walking home from work at about 2 a.m., and at that point was crossing a bridge near, is it Mississauga, Ontario? I want to correctly pronounce
yes.
it, Mississauga, Ontario.
Yes.
Now, you referenced strong reader reaction to this article. You also mentioned reports coming in of odd creatures being seen in the Department of Victoria in Argentina. An inspector from the Municipal Natural Resource Office reportedly encountered an odd creature in the Victoria province in Argentina in the vicinity of campgrounds near a parking lot. Now, any more news about these unusual creatures?
No, and I'm disappointed because I thought there would be, especially because I got into it enough to tell people that they were, thing to note was that they are seen, these creatures were being seen around, like, water, like rivers or where there were water tunnels, like connecting drainage tunnels and things like that, with big enough for, you know, like 3 or 4 feet high. That they were located near these places where these people had these sightings. But no one else has come forward. And I know Steve went and looked, you know, around the area and did not come up, you know, with anything except the fact that he noted that there were these strange drainage pipes all around the area. He saw his creature. But I have no idea what Steve saw. I know he did see something. And it wasn't human, but that leaves, you know, a million ideas what it could be.
All very intriguing. And, you know, Chris, I forgot to reference some article here that I found very interesting, together with the photo that was related to it. It's your article, The Strangest of the Strange UFO Reports. Now, in this article, you describe the experience of the owner of a large land tract in the Canadian wilderness. Reportedly, a huge illuminated craft hovered over the fields in the shape of a multi-story building, and the man took a photo of this object. It is on your website. Very intriguing. It's remarkable.
Yes, yes. That man is very, very private. I mean, talk about threat of death to ever give out his ID. I wasn't even allowed to say for about a year that it was located in the middle of Canada, in the wilderness. That's all he'll allow us to say.
So
but
vast.
At least I can say that. Mm-hmm. But, yes, he claims that it was a flying building. It was a huge building UFO craft. And he also, with that, the photograph displayed something else that looks like an alien behind a tree that we enlarged and showed that he never saw when he was there and didn't like finding in the photo after we showed it to him. I don't know what obviously, whether it was man-made, it was from a different dimension, a different planet, whatever this huge, glowing, building-shaped craft was, it lowered itself, and he said he could see that it was on, you know, attached to the ground somehow in his field and then left, you know, because it wasn't there the next day. Frightened him to death because it was enormous.
That does sound very impressive and definitely would be a daunting sight and experience. But, you know, you have an article, too, you know, I think at least two articles on these UFO objects that resemble the shapes of buildings.
Buildings.
You referenced a 1999 event in Southwest Texas where the lady was driving along the side of a highway, and above the ground she saw the multi-story-shaped building. There was no sound at this time, and the object's exterior lines were blurred. She's not sure of the provenance of that object. And another account you reference is a report from a Colorado couple in 1988, living in southern Colorado at the time. They lived above their store, and they witnessed an odd building-like craft floating above the town streets. There is a government facility in that particular mountain area in the vicinity of that town, reportedly. Any more correspondence on this?
Well, I got about three or four more people coming to me from all over the world telling me, oh, yeah, we saw a floating building, too. Like, you know, doesn't everybody? But we thought it was just, they all think it was like a government program because it was a moving building. But do buildings, like, float above mountain ranges? I don't know. They certainly saw them. A man in England who has a blog site sent me a picture and said, this is not a report. I saw this with my family and friends. And he sent me a picture of an adorable little building that he drew with a balcony and wheels or something. And he claims that rose up in their town and just flew over the rooftops and left. So, you know, I just listen and I go, well, can all these people from all these different places that do not know each other, can they all be crazy, yet be seeing the same exact thing? I doubt that. I think something's going on. But in this case, is it a hologram? Is it a government program testing moving buildings? Because let's face it, in warfare, how easy if we could move a whole hospital or a whole, you know, place for the men to be kept. If we could somehow do it, maybe we are doing it. I don't know. All I know is that people are seeing it, and they are totally confused.
The movie is so anomalous. Very intriguing reports there. Now, Chris, on the subject of chemtrails, you referenced a shopping trip with your family before Christmas. You and your brother observed outside massive chemtrails, clouds with odd colors and which seemed to self-illuminate, and three military jets which seemed to disappear. These are anomalous events. What is the situation there with the chemtrails?
They never stop. We have it, and I'm tired of saying to people, look at that. What do you think that is? Did you ever see that before? Oh, it's always been like that. No, it hasn't. It's never been like that. It's been like that for your sky for like 10 years or something. The chemtrails here, I'm going to this summer. I finally bought a really good camera. I'm going to start to take and document. One day, absolutely not a cloud in the sky. Another day, pouring rain. Then they come back and they spray again. Start out with a blue sky. They start spraying these long, long lines. Many of them, they checkerboard like the sky. And then they pillow out to these huge clouds, pinkish neon in color, and cover the whole entire sky. This repeats over and over and over here where I live. It doesn't matter if the temperature is the same and the conditions are the same 3 days in a row. You have different skies. It's all about what they're spraying. Personally, I think it's either weather modification or possibly a cold war with weather going on, where this is how we defend against having other situations happen to us. Over all land mass. There are lots of things it could be, but I kind of smell the heart machines and weather control in it. And I do think at this point it's probably an effort to manipulate and or protect us from a harp machine disaster all over the world, meaning that it got out of hand, that they're using them for as much evil as they are good. And now we have a world that needs to defend against it as much as use it. So that's just my opinion.
Well, it's very well spoken there, and your elements are, I think, quite strong. Now, Chris, we have about 2 minutes left, and I just wanted to emphasize in your articles the, I think, very wise advice. You note the importance of a person's being aware, informed, keeping that eye out, so that if the unusual occurs, that person could be more ready to deal with the situation. Final comments on that. It's a great piece of advice, great point of advice.
Yes, and I hope everybody truly, truly pays attention to that. It is interesting beyond belief to see something that is unknown and unidentified and unexplained. All of that is wonderful. Do it with a group of people in a well-lit, safe place. Never, ever, if you're traveling alone or just with one other person in the middle of nowhere, get out of your car if you see something coming at you. Try to retreat back to where there's population and lights. And if that's not possible, just try your best to lock yourself in and keep traveling. Never offer yourself up to any creature, being, craft, floating building, anything that you see that you don't understand. First, safety first. And trust me, there's many people that have gone missing that we do not know where they are. Some, I'm sure, have been taken by these things.
Thank you, Chris, for this dynamic and informative discussion. Again, I highly recommend her excellent articles found at Chris Hawley's Paranormal World website, located at endlessjrny.blogspot.com, and the sister site at chrishawley2.blogspot.com. Thank you again, Chris. Discussion very much appreciated.
Well,
next
thank
week's
you
guest,
for having me.
I hope so much you'll be a return guest in the very near future. And I'll definitely continue reading those blogs, your articles, your observations. Very intriguing, very timely.
Well, thank you very much.
And again, thank you for being a guest, Chris. And I hope you'll be back very soon. Now, next week, our guest will be Charles Hall, author of the Millennial Hospitality series. And don't forget our excellent programs on this paranormal network, including Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis with researcher and field historian Dee Andrew, UFO Undercover with Joe Montaldo, Voice of the People with host Greg Miller, and don't miss the program Through the Keyhole with Karen Dolan on Friday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, directly before this program. Great weekend, everyone. Thank you for listening.